Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. We have an incredible show for you this evening. Scott Cartvet is here, call sign Intake. He is going to tell his story about Navy combat flying, the Blue Angels, movie making, stunt flying, and so much more. It is really amazing. I am thrilled that he is here with us tonight. Now, before we get started, just a few things. Social Flight is absolutely booming right now. We're getting to the end of this Fly to Win challenge period, and we are giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. That's going to be given away on February 1st, and we just gave one away recently to John Southworth of Edmonton, Kentucky. It's just such an amazing headset with its canary features that have to do with carbon monoxide detection and hearing acuity that helps you adapt to your particular hearing needs. And all you need to do is get the free Social Flight mobile app for Apple and Android devices. Check in at your local airport just once and you are entered in to win. It is that simple. And within Social Flight at socialflight.com or the mobile apps, we have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations, places to fly to, cool things that we have looked at from all over the country and the world. Check it out. And then we have our FAA Learning Center where you can take courses within that for wings credit. If you are a mechanic, you can take courses for your Aviation Maintenance Technician Awards Program. And also, if you happen to be a mechanic with an inspection authorization, you can get your 8 hours of continuing education directly through Social Flight. Just log into Social Flight, go to the FAA credits section, take the courses, get the certificates. It's all there in Social Flight for you. Now, tonight's program is brought to us by a brand new sponsor. I'm absolutely thrilled that they are here. Hartzell Engine Technologies is a leading manufacturer of aircraft engine accessories, ignition systems, fuel systems, exhaust systems, and so much more. From the Skytech starters that you know to plane power alternators, janitorial heaters, power-up magnetos, these are all names we all know and use and trust in our aircraft, and they all come from Hartzell Engine Technologies. So we'll be delivering a lot of upcoming education on their products, on all the technology, so that you can understand things that you need to know about aerospace welding or about all these different components for your engine. A lot of education is coming. Be sure to check that out. It's coming in Social Flight. You'll hear about it directly from us. And as long as you're a member, you'll just get notified about it. So it is, it's really exciting for us that they help support everything that we are doing here for you. Now on to tonight's guest. Scott Cartvet became a Navy fighter pilot back in 1991 at the controls of the amazing F/A-18 Hornet. He flew with the Blue Angels for 3 years as the number 7, number 6, and number 5 solo pilot, then returned to the fleet to serve in combat in Iraq in 2003 and 2005. Because he was a commanding officer at that point, he served two combat tours in Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010. He ran the Navy's F-35 program in 2011 before being selected as the Navy's first stealth fighter squadron commanding officer. In all, Scott served during 5 combat deployments, flying 91 combat missions, accumulating over 6,300 flight hours and 658 carrier arrested landings on 11 aircraft carriers. After retiring from the Navy, Scott hasn't slowed down one bit. He currently flies for the Patriots Jet Demonstration Team, was a stunt pilot on Top Gun Maverick, and was the Aviation Safety Supervisor in Mission Impossible 8. His sons are both naval aviators following in their father's footsteps. And his book, Full Throttle, tells this amazing story. We're going to talk about that. I strongly encourage you to get out there, get that book, and check it all out for yourself. I am absolutely thrilled to have him with us here tonight on Social Flight Live. Please welcome Scott Cartvet.
Hello, Jeff. How are you? Hello, Social Fly. What a pleasure to be here with you this evening. And thanks for having me on the show. Shout out to everybody that signed on, and it's great to be here.
Thank you so much, Scott, for taking time to join us here on the show and share your story. It is absolutely remarkable. You could have written two books and still probably not gotten through what your experiences have been. Take me back and help me understand what kindled this love of aviation and also the combination of wanting to serve your country.
So my grandfather and father were both in the Navy, and so we had a history of patriotic service. So I really didn't know anything other than the Navy. When I was a senior in 1986 at Valhalla High School, that May 1986 is when Top Gun came out, the first one. And my best friend Bob and I saw that movie and told all of our friends, like any arrogant, boisterous 18-year-old would, full of testosterone, we're going to be fighter pilots. We both went to college, and at the end of college, he had gone to Air Force ROTC and said, I got my undergraduate pilot training slot. We said we were going to do it. I'm doing it. And I literally hung up the phone with Bob, picked up the yellow pages for your younger listeners. That's the flip through Google that we used to have. And I called the Navy recruiter out of the Los Angeles recruiting district. And that's really what started the journey when I applied to aviation officer candidate school.
Wow. And tell me what that was, because the exposure that most of us have for Navy's officer candidate school is we all know, right? It was an officer and a gentleman. Like, that's what we all grew up on.
And it is shockingly like officer and a gentleman, for sure. So I went ahead and applied in 1991. I was a practicing accountant for KPMG Pete Marwick in Century City, California.
Really?
I was working for them, had been hired. I had sat for the CPA exam. But to be honest, I have always been an adrenaline junkie. We had been riding off-road motorcycles, actually in the winter training area where the Blue Angels practice. So I can remember 7, 8, 9 years old seeing the Blue Angels fly over A-4s. But it was really Top Gun, the original, that I thought, I want to do that. I want to fly airplanes off of ships, which is what I told the recruiter. And in 1991, he said, so does everybody. And I said, yeah, I think I can do it. And so we started the application process. And I was fortunate enough to get selected at the about the middle of 1991. And I started aviation officer candidate school in August of 91.
So you certainly knew from your family background a little bit about what to expect. What was it for you as an actual experience?
Well, that's actually not entirely true. My to all the mechanics that you have on the show, one, thank you. But also, my grandfather was an ADC. He was a chief in the Navy and worked on helicopters in World War II. My dad was a submariner. And when I got accepted to flight school about 2 weeks before I went to AOCS, I had never been in a small airplane. So I went to Santa Monica Airport, where it said, pay $35 for an intro to flight program. And I walked in and I said, I'm going to Navy flight training in about 2 weeks. I'd like to get up in an airplane. And the guy said, well, you're a little behind. And I said, well, let's go up and fly around a little bit. So he was kind enough to give me two of those flights before I went to Pensacola.
Wow. And what is, take me through what it's like to walk in the door of Pensacola and go through that.
The memory that really sticks out, you've seen the drill instructors, and at the time we had candidate officers, and I had been wearing a suit in Los Angeles and dealing with very large companies in a very corporate environment. And I remember walking in, and they opened we were one of the last ones in because we were trying to delay the inevitable yelling and screaming and push-ups. And I remember they unzipped my suitcase, threw it at the end of the hall with all of the other open suitcases, had us bracing against the wall. And I remember thinking, what on earth have I gotten myself into? This is not how professionals treat each other. But that was the very first moment where I realized that they were going to break us down as individuals and give us a common purpose, which was the Constitution, and rebuild us into warfighters, which is exactly what they did.
And did you have any moments of kind of challenge during all of that, during that process, or did you feel you were 100% all the way?
No, I knew that I was 100% all the way. There was no way that I was going to go back home. In the particular class that I was in, which was 0292, we started with over 40. And after, I think it's Black Friday is the day when you first meet the Marine drill instructors, they wake you up at 5 with the garbage cans, just like everything you've seen in the movies. And we lost so many people. We got down to 13 in the drill. Oh, yeah. And your expression is the expression I get all the time. And he pulled us aside and said, look, if we lose one more person, you're going to roll to another class. And so the 13, and he left us, and the 13 of us decided that we were not going to let each other down. And we went through the rest of the 16-week course.
Wow. Wow. So you make it through OCS, and now tell me about Navy flying.
So I was very fortunate when I went to primary flight training. There's always a number of people that go through OCS and they want to fly helicopters or they want to fly maritime. At the time it was the P3, now it's P8. And I knew that I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and there were a handful of others in the group that wanted to be fighter pilots or fly off of aircraft carriers. And so interestingly, the two roommates that I had that were as passionate as I was, we decided to rent a house. And the three of us, I'll tell you about my journey, but J.J. Cummings went on to command the USS Ford. Scott Tingle went on to become an astronaut. I actually just had some communication with him because today, as a matter of fact. And so that household, we pushed each other, we challenged each other, and we, a rising tide raises all boats. And we were all successful in getting into fighters. Which was, and I attribute much of that success to those two, because when we had challenges in flight school, and to me it was the hardest thing I had ever done, learning the three-dimensional space, especially in instruments, and we just helped each other. We didn't try to compete against each other. We just kept raising each other up, and so that was kind of foundationally how I went through flight training.
And what a testament to really that program and what it means to fly for the Navy, that these core friends that you had, that you worked with to get through this program, were such amazing individuals that went on to do such amazing things.
Yeah, very blessed with it, which goes to, surround yourself with good people and good things will happen for sure.
Wow. So, all right, you sent me a pretty impressive story of your son doing his first carrier landing. Tell me about your first carrier landing.
Honestly, I don't remember much about the first day landing. We were off the coast of Key West when I went down. And so I remember becoming a tailhook aviator in that regard, and I remember the qualification, but the first landing, I don't really recall. I remember approaching the ship. I remember looking down at the ship and thinking, wow, that's a lot smaller than I expected. I remember the heart rate increasing, hands getting sweaty, but you train to such a level that you just go into your training, right? You fall to the lowest level of your training, and Navy training is very high. But I will tell a quick story about the first night landing, which was in F-18s. And for your listeners, you would think that a full moon would be a blessed sight because you get to see more, but you actually can get a little complacent in that environment. So we happened to be off the coast of Key West again, getting the first night landing in the F-18. And I remember coming down the chute, and it was a full moon, and I had already landed during the day a couple of years prior in the T-2 and then again in the A-4. So I felt a little comfortable, but the night ball game, it's a totally different ball game. And I remember coming down, and you get to 3/4 of a mile and you call the ball, and I must have just gone catatonic and stopped moving the throttles and the stick, although I'm sure that I was continuing to work. But I just remember the great big red wave off lights because clearly I wasn't giving them what they needed to see. But that was a little bit of a gut check to go, okay, you've seen it. You know what it looks like. And I can talk about the visual illusions at night that I fell, I don't want to say I fell victim to, because I wasn't a victim. I just stopped flying the ball. And so I went around, and on the downwind, you know, you kind of, all right, let's get it together. And you're trained, you're ready, and you can do this like so many naval aviators have before. But that one very distinctly I recall.
You know, that's, I think it's really important, because it's so, it's so easy with folks that are as accomplished as you, for everyone, for all our viewers, for anyone who sees this, to think, well, they're all supermen. They don't suffer from any of the same challenges that I do. And to hear that, the vulnerabilities, to hear the mistakes, to hear the challenges that you face, I think makes it, tells a story that helps everyone.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. As we were going through training, we would get together with other pilots, many from my OCS class. And the two that I told you about, JJ and Scott, we would get together at these on Friday night when we would finally let our hair down, because we had some time off after a very intense week. And we would always tell about the things that we messed up during the week, and we would laugh about it. And I remember somebody coming up to me and saying, you know, you always talk about the stuff you screw up. You never tell the stories of the things that you do right. And I said, well, those don't make a great story. And I'm learning from JJ, and I'm learning from Scott and the errors that they make. And again, foundationally, that is naval aviation. That's why we debrief. That's why we how we accelerate our performance. I don't want to make all the mistakes. I want to learn from everybody else's mistake as I continue to sharpen the steel of my sword. And naval aviation is incredible. I think all aviation, with compartmentalizing, that you have to be present in the moment. And when you close the door to your aircraft and it is time to go flying, it's time to be present in that moment until you're chalked, right? We fly chalk to chalk.
That makes a lot of sense. You opened the door to something that I am absolutely going to bite on, and that is the different illusions that you can have, because we've certainly been blessed to have others that have landed on a carrier on the show. I've never had anyone who can really describe those challenges and who's offered to tell us some of that. Can you tell me a little bit about what a naval aviator faces with illusions landing on the deck of a carrier?
Sure. So here's what happens at night physiologically. And so you push out of Marshall and you come down. Often there's a marine layer. And so if there's a little bit of light, I just constantly turning down my rheostats, because you want your cones and rods set for night landing. And the ship is not bright. They keep the ship fairly dark because they don't want to damage your night vision. You know, anytime if you took a flashlight at night and shined it in your eyes, you'd kind of go blind. So you kind of make everything as dark as you can. And so what happens in the airplane is you dirty up and begin to slow down and configure the airplane with gear and flaps. And an F-18, your approach speed is somewhere between 130, 150 knots. And once you stabilize and you are configured vestibularly, your body doesn't sense motion because you don't have the peripheral vision to tell you that you are continuing to move through space. And to demonstrate that, the next time you're a passenger in a car at night, passenger, not driving, close your eyes when you have established a steady speed, and you'll have the same sensation. You're not accelerating, you're not decelerating, the vestibular system in your ear won't tell you, and you can sense that you're not really moving. And so what happens is you push over, you start your descent, your 3-degree glide slope at 3 miles, and your eyes and your vestibular system sense that you're not moving. So what we have to fight and what we have to train to is, as you approach the ship and you begin to make out the ship, an illusion that can take place is that the ship is now moving towards you instead of you moving towards the ship, which will naturally, you will defensively begin to add power to get rid of this beast that is coming up out of the water towards you. And so we train extensively to fly meatball lineup and angle of attack. And the meatball doesn't lie, even if the deck is moving or you get some sort of oscillation in the deck, the Fresnel lens or the meatball has the capability to counter that. So when you see a centered ball, you are in fact centered, and to not believe the seat of your pants and continue to fly meatball lineup and angle of attack all the way to touchdown.
Wow. And have you had very difficult landings on pitching decks and things that at night?
You tell the stories that you learn from. And so you make power corrections, and sometimes the ship will make its own wind and it can travel at, 20 to 30 knots, which decreases your approach speed. So hypothetically, let's say we're approaching the ship at 140 knots. We like 20 to 30 knots of wind over the deck, which slows the relative motion down to 110 to, 120 knots. Which is helpful, but you can start to see what we call a Dutch roll as a carrier moves through, or if it is creating its own wind, then you get what we call the burble, as the wind comes over, just like a wing, as the wind comes over the bow and accelerates to meet the wind at the back of the ship, it hits the water and then will kick up like a rooster tail, and you can't see it, but you will get a floaty at the start. We call it the start, in the middle, enclosed, and at the ramp. And so you'll get a little bit of a burble, and you can't aggressively correct off to that, because then you're going to get the sink as soon as you fly through the burble. And so you learn all of those things as you go. And then the wake, and whether you see the wake, and the 10 degree offset has you constantly making right corrections, because the ship is moving in one direction and the lineup of the 10 degree cut of the carriers is moving away, which causes that kind of micro right wing down all the time. And then every time you drop the wing, you got to add a little power, make a correction. And so that all becomes very natural. And so at one point I had hit the burble. I had made an aggressive power correction for the high and didn't get it in time. So we call it a setting sun, as the ball went from high screaming through center into red, because it will change colors from amber below the datums. I just remember again getting a wave off, and this was the one time where I remember going full afterburner, because I had picked up the rate at which the ball was going down in close to the ramp, and I just remember kind of going, oh, this is gonna be dicey. and not wanting to hit the back of the ship or come crashing down into the landing area, because I had picked up too much of a rate of descent.
Wow.
Which is fly the ball all the way to touchdown. Sorry, the stories are so long, but I'm trying to paint a picture for those that are listening on audio.
Oh, the one thing you should never do is apologize for your stories. I thought it fascinating what you said, because obviously you look at how the carriers are designed and you see that you are not landing in line with the tower on the, and the length of the ship. But it never occurred to me, yeah, that's the direction you're going, and you're constantly skipping to the right to come in. That is really, really interesting. I hadn't really thought about that. Another aspect that I've always heard is challenging to learn in the beginning is aerial refueling. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's a controlled midair collision is what it is. And so the Navy will plug into a drogue, so the air refueling aircraft will drop a drogue out, and it will have, for those that can't see my hands, it's a pretty big basket. I don't remember the exact dimensions, but let's say it's 2 to 3 feet across. And as you approach the basket, it will get into the bow wave of the aircraft that you're flying. And when it hits that bow wave, it will move up and right. And so the idea behind it is to keep a constant speed and closure rate, let that basket hit the bow wave, move up and right to where the probe is, and then go into the basket. And about half the diameter of the refueling basket, you can hit, even though you may not be directly into where the fuel comes from, and it will move and you'll go into where you get the fuel. If you get outside of that, we call it lipping the basket, and then the basket will correct and move around fairly violently. But what normally happens when you approach the basket is when you're first learning is you're literally going to connect with the other plane. And so people will keep their closure rate up and then they'll kind of throttle back and stop. Mm. And then, when I was in the service, we would teach back up, get 5-6 feet back, and then reattempt. Now, interestingly, the KC-135 has a very short drogue capability on it. And I'll say, it seemed like it was 6 to 8 feet. And so, and it has a much smaller basket. We called it the Iron Maiden. And so when we were in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, sometimes some of the most intense thing we would do was tank off the KC-135, not because anything they were doing, they were giving us the most stable platform we could, but you might be in the weather, you could be in clouds, you're low on fuel, and you have to make sure you accurately connect with that other airplane.
Wow. Is there some kind of competitiveness or jabbing between the different branches of military for the guys that refuel with a boom instead of you guys that go and hit a chute?
As a courtesy to the others, we like the way that we do it. And so as the Navy pilot, we are the ones that are controlling the connection. And so the Air Force drogue operator will plug the aircraft behind the pilot's head, and the pilot will fly formation off of the larger aircraft. And then the drogue operator is the one that makes the contact. And as a Navy fighter pilot, I would just as soon control that connection, if you will.
I like that. That is very, very cool. Okay. And before we go into obviously your next phase of flying and getting selected for the Blues, you do have to tell us intake. How did you get named?
So if I turn to the profile for those that have visuals, I have a big nose and I take in more than my fair share of air, just like the intake of a jet engine. So that's where intake came from. And actually, JJ gave it to me in AOCS and it just stuck. And I'm happy because I don't know any other intake. So my oldest son and youngest son, when they were going through Navy flight training, we have a very unique last name, Kartfett. And other pilots that knew me would come up and say, "Hey, are you intake son?" And their answer was, "Well, that depends what you think of intake."
I love it. All right. So now you've got your carrier landings in and you're obviously been deployed at that point. Tell me about first of all, what drove you to apply for the Blue Angels and then about getting selected?
So I could probably relate it back to flying or riding motorcycles in El Centro. And I just thought it would be incredible flying. And I knew early on through my first operational tour over in Japan that is what I wanted to do. And I talked to my commanding officer and executive officer and department heads about it, that it was something that I wanted to apply. And so I'm never afraid of failing or making a mistake, or, I own my errors and learn from them. And so I was a flight instructor at a VMFAT 101, the Marine Corps RAG in San Diego, actually originally El Toro. We moved it to San Diego down at Miramar. And I had applied in 1998, was selected as a finalist. And then interestingly, this is just another great story for your listeners. I had applied, I had been selected as a finalist, and Doug Verissimo had one of the standard questions is, "Tell us the dumbest thing that you have ever done in an airplane." And I thought, well, I'm applying for the Blue Angels, I've got to be a great pilot. So I told him I was 50 feet off altitude in a T-34 and some BS story that I thought would make me look good. And that was the year that I wasn't selected. And then I reapplied the second year and they had asked me again, "What's the dumbest thing that you had ever done in an airplane?" And I told them the story of, we were doing an air power demonstration, dropping live ordnance off the coast of Japan for the Japanese chief of naval operations and his delegation. So the senior naval officer in the Japanese Navy. And I was a wingman on that flight, and I was inside of the flight lead, between the flight lead and the carrier, and we were flying pretty tight formation, but we dropped our Mark 82s right too close to the carrier. And so some bomb fragments had landed on the carrier, and the Japanese CNO dove on the deck, and the deck of an aircraft carrier is hydraulic fluid, oil, fuel, and it also has non-skid. And so he had gotten his whites dirty. And so I told them that story, and we had been looked into and we were grounded. And it was such an infamous story at the time in naval aviation that a good friend of mine, Dave Silkey, was the slot pilot at the time on the team, said, "That was you?" And I said, "Yes, but let me tell you what I learned from it." And I went through advocating as a wingman because I felt that we were close, but I didn't tell the flight lead because he was senior to me, and just being part of the flight. And I shared with them what I had learned. And interestingly, I told them this story that could have had catastrophic results. And that was the year that they picked me. And the reason that I believe that they picked me is because I was willing to own my errors. And if I'm willing to own my errors, then I can accelerate my performance. And the Blue Angel debriefs can be, I don't want to say aggressive. Aggressive isn't the right term. They can be ruthlessly honest. Mm. And you need somebody that isn't going to try to cover up the mistakes or the errors or be willing to take feedback to be better. And so that was a really critical lesson to me.
Wow. That's a good lesson, I think, to anyone, the idea of that brutal honesty and owning your mistakes and how important that is to your personal development and also to what it can do to actually help you professionally when you think it could hurt you.
Well, and on the Blue Angels, we all own our errors. We call them taking a safety anytime we deviate from standard operating procedures. And what that does for the team and the organization is it builds trust and respect and confidence so that you would know if you and I were flying together, Jeff, and I told you my mistakes and my good, the things that I did well, that you know that we're learning and evolving together. And if I trust and respect you because you're willing to acknowledge the areas that you can improve on, there's great acceleration for any organization or team at any level.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think people can apply that to in any facet of life, even for a job interview or something like that, where everyone's tendency is to say, "Oh, what's your greatest weakness? I care too much." You know, like all that.
I'm a perfectionist. I always show up on time.
That's my greatest weakness. But yet when you really tell a story of a mistake you've made and you've learned from, it's like, oh my God, that's the person I want. That's the one. That's fascinating. So, so what was it like? What was it like flying for the Blue Angels during your tours?
So the first year I was number seven, and a lot of the pilots that are selected to the team don't like the number seven position because you're kind of the aide-de-camp for the demonstration team and the demonstration pilots. You organize the car in the hotels, and you execute the air show Thursday through Friday. And so you're kind of working for everybody, but that didn't faze me at all. I thought it was a great position because I was the only pilot in the Navy with two F-18s assigned specifically to me to get exactly where I needed to go. I got to do all the VIP rides. I probably flew 150 people in the back of the F-18, and the narration piece I enjoyed because it was an opportunity to get in front of the crowd and move the emotion of the crowd as the team was flying. And then I was selected because they select the positions in the October timeframe, late September, early October. And I was asked by the team to be the number six pilot as the opposing solo with my good friend Keith Hoskins, who was number five, the previous number six. And so you think you're a good pilot. You have several thousand hours. You've flown on and off of carriers. But I can remember doing drills in the Southern California desert to try to get the knife edge perfect, you know, ready, hit it, knife edge, ready, hit it, knife edge, and just running lines of knife edge and the same thing with inverted until you can. And every movement for the solo pilots is a full stick deflection because it's the only way that we can move the airplanes simultaneously at the same time. And so I look back on tapes when I was flying, and the precision, even to me now, 20 plus years later, I'll say it's impressive, but every Blue Angel pilot goes through that. And then we move into the formation flying and the precision and the skill of that. So everybody thinks about the flying. What I take away from the team and my time on the team is the ability to positively influence others in their lives, whether it's through high school visits, veteran home visits, hospital visits, the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and the people that are operating at such a high level. The flying, yes, it was eye-watering and it was intense, but the opportunity to rent or to represent 330,000 sailors and 180,000 Marines and all of our armed forces, that's an honor. What a treat.
Yeah, absolutely. What did you learn from the fact that you can take these consummate professionals with such amazing skills with their aircraft, and yet through a season you get that dramatic progression of how your performance is and how close you fly together?
The trust and respect piece. And so, you know, we start the first show, and I was with the team on Saturday. They do a thing called Graybeards, and we go down and we watch them practice, and it's late January, and we pass on some of our lessons learned, which is really what the 79-year culture of the team is about, a constant improvement. But half of the formation is new every year. And so the first show, in our view, they'll be fairly far apart, metal to metal, and then you take that to the end of the season because of the constant improvement. And I have flown so close to another airplane in some of the Delta sets that you can just perceive the lao or the wingtip of the F-18, and you can just see it right here. I mean, it's 12 inches away, where we talk about at that level breathing away, where you just squeeze the stick and move the aircraft. When I'm talking about moving the aircraft, you're moving it maybe an inch to give yourself just a little bit more room. So, but the intensity of that is so pure. I would often get asked, Jeff, you know, what do you think about when you're at the top of the line of breast loop and all six of you are inverted and you're getting ready to break out? And I said, I have no idea what I think about. What does a professional NFL linebacker think about as he's ready to tackle a professional running back? I don't know that they could describe it other than their body is functioning as a single element in that moment. The intensity is phenomenal, and it's a rush.
Wow. Let's turn the table a little bit towards your combat time. And I think it's interesting to think about that as a transition from your Blue Angels time. Tell me about what it was like to fly in combat, and also what kind of influence maybe there was from your time in the Blue Angels.
So the idea is to take the culture of the Blue Angels and kind of emanate that throughout the fleet, where the unit comes first ahead of any individual. And so I left the team in November of 2002, and I was in shock and awe in early April of 2003. And so I went back to the Fleet Replacement Squadron so that I could do some weapons training. I'd been flying with the team for 3 years. But shock and awe was getting ready to kick off. And they said, hey, intake, you're not going to do any of that weapons training. We'll give you some simulators. Then you're going to go to the carrier, get carrier qualified, because you have to do that. And then you're headed over to the USS Roosevelt in the Mediterranean. And I said, well, I really need the weapons training because I haven't done it in 3 years and some of the weapons have changed. And they said, yeah, but you're a Blue Angel. And I said, well, if you want me to fly over the Iraqis inverted at 200 feet, I am literally the best in the world. But if you want to employ weapons against them, I might need some training. And so they said, yeah, you'll get that in the airplane. So I flew out to the Roosevelt. I had been carrier qualified. We did one flight around the Roosevelt, and my second flight off of the Roosevelt was with a full ordnance load over Turkey getting ready to turn south into Iraq, into the Mosul and Tikrit area. But the skills and the situational awareness that I had developed within the Blue Angels and as a Navy fighter pilot, I just had to learn the employment of the weapons system and the JDAM and the GPS guided weapons. And so on an encrypted radio over Turkey, we were reviewing the employment of those weapons before we hit the tanker and turned south. And as it turns out, the Navy was right and it all worked out.
That is the most impressive description of on-the-job training I may have ever heard. Yeah,
I thought so at the time as well, for sure.
Yeah, that's a little bit more than, don't worry, we're going to teach you how to shuffle the papers when you get there. No.
That's right.
So what was it like? Tell me about your combat experience.
So you clearly ramp up very fast, and I was on the team when September 11th happened, and so we were very ready to turn the Blue Jets into Gray Jets and go fight it. As it turned out, it took until 2003 before we decided to go after the enemy that attacked our country. And so the passion and the purity of the purpose was very clear. And to tell all your listeners, I am most proud of my combat time. The Blue Angels was incredible and a great honor, but I am most proud of the people and the sailors that I served with to support and defend the Constitution. And so I do remember turning south, and we had dominated the airspace. We had air superiority. And now it was just a matter of eliminating targets on the ground. And so you could still see AAA, and I'm sure you've seen it on television where we're wearing our night vision goggles, and that's the green image that you see of the AAA. And they still had surface-to-air guided guidance systems. And so you might get lit up by a surface-to-air guidance system, but they very rarely after the first week or two of the war, launched a surface-to-air missile at an aircraft, because if they did, then we would know where that site was and we would immediately destroy it. But it was high intensity, but at that point we were certainly the dominant force and we were just trying to destroy them, for lack of a better term.
Wow. I want to show a couple images of your time there and on the carrier in service. And you mentioned that it takes a team.
Yeah, Jeff, this is actually one of my favorite pictures. I was in command at the time with VF-83. We had won the Battle E as the most efficient and effective combat unit in 2009 and 10. But I just happened to be doing my job as a pilot and employing the weapons. But in that picture are plane captains, ordnance men, avionics techs. And we had just an absolutely incredible unit. I just happened to be one member of it with the privilege to lead. So that, to me, epitomizes what we had going at VFA-83.
Wow. There's a few here, so I'm going to step through a couple. Of course, this shows what you were describing before of what it's like to fuel.
Yeah, that's the Iron Maiden, and I took that picture with a wingman taking off the Iron Maiden. And for those that can see the picture, you can see that very short bend in the drogue from the KC-135 and maintain that bend in the drogue while you're getting your fuel. And I would always wiggle my toes. And when I told my boys as they began refueling was, it gets intense, wiggle your toes and do what you're trained to do.
I like the wiggle your toes thing. That's kind of definitely appropriate there. There's a few others here that are really I just found such striking images.
Yeah, so that was just a couple of fighters. It was actually taken by out the window of one of the aerial refuelers in Afghanistan, and you can see Afghanistan below us. And so oftentimes you would talk and they would know what unit we were with, and then they would take those pictures. Like, that's an incredible picture of the two airplanes, and we knew that they were taking the picture. They pulled the drogue back and the refueling probe so they could get those pictures, and oftentimes they were kind enough to send it to us to get that two F-18s fully loaded, full ordnance, getting ready to do what we do.
Wow. And there's another one that is just absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah, and so that one is a Super Hornet, and you can tell by the leading edge extension, it's a little bit bigger and the probe is out, but because they're getting ready to refuel, and I thought that was just an incredible picture. That was one of the units, either VFA 143 or VFA 103 that were part of the air wing with us. And then that's actually my jet. That previous one was my command jet. You can tell with the colors. And we, prior to becoming VF-83, we were VF-191. And so the bowl on the back of the tail is VF-191, which was honoring those that had gone before us, and we took them into battle with us. And then the next picture that you showed was Monica Barbaro as we were training her for Top Gun Maverick. And then there's
about that in a little bit. I wanted to get the carrier one, of course.
Yeah, that's the ready room. We're in our desert flight suits, and all of the pilots that we flew with in 2010 when I had command of VFA-83, and our incredible maintainers that gave us the airplanes to go and do our mission. They had to do theirs first to ensure that when we hit the pickle button or pulled the trigger, that ordnance would come out and that the aircraft would work. Proud of that picture as well.
And this also is another incredible picture.
Yeah, that's right off of the waist. So catapult 4 off of the USS Eisenhower, getting ready to launch and go do some work. It's a great shot as you're just leaving the carrier. And I always joke with people, always think that the landing is the scariest. But in fact, I always found the catapult the scariest because you don't know if you're an airplane or a refrigerator and whether you have the end speed to get launched. And so you're looking at the airspeed and you can feel the acceleration because you're going from zero to about 150 knots in less than 2 seconds. It's like getting shot out of a gun.
I like that. You don't know yet if you're an aircraft or a refrigerator.
So that's at my change command. Roy Kelly, the air wing commander, was giving me a meritorious service award for command of VFA-83. And there, and Aaron is one of the incredible maintainers that we had in the background of that picture, and he was the MC of that event. Very proud event to conclude my command tour and 2 combat deployments. That's the whole squadron. You can see the colors of the administrators, the ordies, the flight deck personnel, the aviation techs, right there on the Eisenhower with our jet, and that's the whole team. That earned the Battle Efficiency Award, the Michael J. Astoshin Award, the Safety Award. They were absolutely an incredible, talented group of sailors. And when you leave the service, that's what you miss, is the men and women that you have the pleasure of working with.
Well, there's one other thing here I definitely want to get to show, just because if anything's going to put a smile on anybody's face, it's going to be the idea that you had this.
Yeah, so the action figure, the intake action figure. Now, any fighter pilot will call it a doll, but I want to point out to those that it says Elite Force action figure on the box. But I don't know any fighter pilot that has ever called it an action figure. And many of the units that I was with after that came out when I was on the team, they did very abusive things to that. And I reminded them that when the Barbie movie came out, that Ken is a Barbie, intake is an action figure.
That is impressive. So tell me about your, we brought the picture up before, of course, but tell me about flying for the movies. Tell me about what was involved. Here you are with Phoenix, and tell me about this whole experience.
So it's interesting, and I get asked all the time, how did you get involved with Top Gun Maverick? And when I retired from the service out of F-35 command and joined United Airlines as a pilot, My good friend John Wygand, who was the managing director of Standard, said, "Hey, look, you know a lot about air shows, so how about you run the United Airlines 777 demonstration team?" And I said, "Sure, I do know a lot about air shows." So it was kind of like being number seven for the 777 air demonstration team. And I think Joe Sobczak said he was going to listen in. So shout out to Joe. He was the chief demonstration pilot at the time. And Lauren Einsettler, who was also part of that team. And so I took on that role. And in 2017, while I was at the San Francisco Fleet Week show at the United Maintenance Facility, the Patriot Jet Team was there. I didn't even know the Patriot Jet Team existed. And it's a six-ship jet demonstration team. It's the only one, certainly in North or South America. It's a civilian jet team. And I knew Scott End Banker, who was the number six pilot on the team. And we happened to bump into each other on the ramp. And he said, "Hey, intake, good to see you. How's the wife? How are the kids? And would you be, we're looking for a guy. Are you interested?" And my motto through life has always been to say yes, because you never know what opportunity is going to avail itself. And 2 weeks later, I was flying with my good friend Randy Howell, who owns the Patriot Jet Team, and they kind of took me through. This is crazy for the pilots that are out there, just to explain it really quick. So I flew with John Pawson. He was the number three pilot, and Randy and I went out and flew. We did some formation flying, and Randy wanted to know if – actually, I flew with Randy in his jet, and he wanted to just see if I could fly an airplane. And so I must have passed that test, because we went back, landed, we debriefed, we jump in at two airplanes, and Randy says, "Hey, why don't you get in this L-39 in the front seat?" And I said, "Randy, I don't know anything about the L-39. I don't know. It's all in kilometers per hour. It's Russian. I don't even know what the switches say." And he said, no, I'll walk you through that. And John Pawson boards will be in your backseat. He was a number three pilot, and he'll make sure you're safe. And so when you start the airplane, this is how you start it, flip these switches. So we went out and did some formation maneuvering, and I must have done okay, because they decided to take me in a formation loop. And I missed the pull on the loop, which the competitiveness in me got frustrated. So I pulled to the inside of the turn circle, and I rejoined inverted at the top of the loop and finished the remainder of the loop. And when Randy and Boards got on the ground, Boards said, "I've never seen anybody rejoin inverted at the top of a loop." And so they offered me the job, and it's an all volunteer job. And it is my passion in life is to go fly with that team, because it brings back the team and the camaraderie, so which leads to Maverick. So Randy and Kevin LaRosa put together CineJet to put in a cinematography application, basically, for Top Gun Maverick. Yep. And they won it with CineJet. And when we were training Glenn and Monica and Jay and Danny and all the actors and actresses, Tom as well, Randy, with my combat experience, said, "Hey, will you come out and train them out of Camarillo, California?" This was in the late fall of 2018. And I said, "Of course, my gosh," to go full circle from seeing Top Gun as a and being inspired by it to be involved in any way, shape, or form. So we took the actors and actresses out. We took them through mock simulation. We pulled 8 Gs with them. And I thought that was it. And then in June of 2019, Randy called and said, "Hey, we need a stunt pilot to film the final portion, the final fight scene of Maverick. They're done with the active duty F-18 flying. Will you do it?" And I said, "Yes." So I take it back, saying yes to lead the United Airlines demonstration team really led me to Maverick. And I said yes to the Patriot Jet Team. I said yes to train the actors and actresses. I said yes to be a stunt pilot. And United has been incredible allowing me to do that. So Randy and I went out 2 weeks later, flew those final 7 minutes, flying about three times a day out of Chico in Northern California, and then back in Camarillo to get the ocean scenes. And it was awesome. Sorry, that's an exceptionally long story, but I think the build is important.
It's wonderful. And you know, Kevin LaRosa was here on the show talking about that. It's so amazing to me and so wonderful that we think of aviation as a tight-knit community, no matter where you are in it.
Yeah.
even when, you know, we look at the folks that we each see on the ramp every day and that you meet at a fly-in or an event, and yet the same thing happens for those, even at those elite levels, like what you're doing and flying in a demonstration team in jets or making a movie. It is the connections between folks who, for example, have been here on Social Flight Live is truly, truly wonderful and heartwarming to see. And this, of course, is Kevin and you in the picture.
And Randy, and that's us with the Screen Actors Guild Stunt Ensemble Award that we won as a result of our efforts in Top Gun Maverick.
Oh, how absolutely wonderful. I want to turn to the foundation, the Blue Angels Foundation,
yeah,
and the work that you do here and the work you do on that and the home base program. Talk to me a little bit about that, because this is so, so, so important.
So I was asked to join the Blue Angel Foundation as a board of director probably 5 years ago now, 2020, 2021. And the Blue Angel Foundation grew from a scholarship foundation for fallen Blue Angels. And it happened to take place in September or October of 1999. I was on the team. I was what they call a khaki newbie. And we lost Kieran O'Connor and Kevin Colling in that accident. And the foundation was started to provide scholarship funds for those kids. And so to 20 years later, now be on the board of directors, and we have grown the foundation to become a veteran support organization, where we use the brand of the Blue Angels Foundation to raise dollars. And we have transitioned, we still have a scholarship component, but we have grown it to over $5 million a year to raise money to provide intensive PTSD treatment with our partner home base in Massachusetts General Hospital. We just opened a TBI clinic this fall in Boston. We opened with our partner Lakeview and home base, opened a behavioral health and PTSD clinic in Pensacola. We're announcing a new one in May in Houston, which is absolutely incredible. And so we are the funding arm of that. Home base brings in their experts to provide the intensive PTSD treatment. And they have developed a 2-week program for veterans and their families, because family members can have PTSD, knowing that their husbands, wives, daughters, sons are in combat. And so they get to go to this treatment in Boston free of charge. And rather than, the VA is an incredible organization and they support our veterans, but oftentimes it's difficult and you might get one appointment every 2 weeks. And this treatment is 8 hours a day with others that are going through the same. And they have a 93% success rate of overcoming PTSD through home base and our partner. And so that's one element. Another element is transitional housing for veterans. And we work with Freedom Station out of San Diego, California. So a veteran might end up with a prosthetic or a service dog or be in a wheelchair, and they finish their occupational therapy, their physical therapy at a military hospital, and then they're released and sent home. And this transitional housing allows them, we build them in a horseshoe shape with a fire pit and a gathering area in the center, and they can move into this transitional housing so that they can now learn how to live with their new physical and mental disabilities. And at the end of the day, imagine learning how to live without an arm or a leg or multiple limb injuries or a service dog or in a wheelchair. And you can go out to this fire pit in the evening with others that are experiencing the same complications. And that's where they can grow together and learn to live with their new reality. And we just opened Freedom Station 3 in San Diego last week, actually. So you've heard me talk about the sailors and the Marines and the men and women that I had the pleasure of serving with. And so I see this as an opportunity to serve. It's all volunteer and continue to give back to our armed forces. And the Blue Angel Foundation is a trusted brand so they can have anonymity and continuity and care. I'm wildly...
How do people find out about that so they can support the Blue Angels Foundation?
So blueangelsfoundation.org. It's a very, you can click donate now. It's rapidly quick. I've actually timed it. You can do it in about 36 seconds to donate money through the website. And we have designed it to be fast and join our database and get newsletters on what the foundation is doing and who we're supporting and where your dollars are going. And so we're ranked with a score of 100 with Charity Navigator, which means that the dollars that you give go towards our veterans, and we have very low administrative costs. So, and we're proud of that as well. I appreciate you letting me say that, Jeff. Thank you.
Absolutely. I think it's a wonderful thing that you guys are doing. I think that home base program sounds, I cannot imagine a more worthy program.
It's incredible.
They're so successful at it, and they can do it in such an intensive way and give those veterans that have given so much to our country their lives back and not have to wait years in order to do that is just, it's really important. I think people should absolutely give to that program. I'm grateful that you were on the board helping make that happen.
Yeah, I actually took over as president about 14-15 months ago, and it's a volunteer job, but it's my full-time job. But I'm passionate about it, and it means so much to me about giving back and taking care of those that have given so much. So thank you.
Yeah, and that's blueangelsfoundation.org, correct?
Yes, sir.
Excellent, excellent. And then, of course, as I mentioned at the beginning and a couple times here, for anyone listening, you want to really get in to understanding this story of Scott. Here's the book, Full Throttle. I'll tell you go out there, find it. Obviously, it's on Amazon. Where else can people get it?
Amazon is the quickest, the easiest, the fastest. And I donate some of the proceeds, 10% to our veterans in the foundation. So if you buy the book, you're doing good things as well. And I thank you.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, Scott, we've reached the part of the program. We like to do something called Social Flight's Fast Five. How does that sound to you?
Bring it. Let's do it, Jeff.
All right. Scott Carpet, this is your Social Flight's Fast Five. Five questions to let people get to know you. You are such an amazing individual with both your combat flying, the Blue Angels, stunt pilot flying on Top Gun Maverick and Mission Impossible 8, the work you do with the Blue Angels Foundation, so many, so many things. And I would like to start with the first question, which is, you went through all this training, you've done a lot of military training, obviously, and flown a variety of aircraft as part of it. Is there one particular aircraft? I mean, we didn't even obviously talk that much. You got to the F-35. What aircraft is kind of closest to your heart, do you feel is the biggest, put it on like a glove?
Buno number 161963. I've got about 4,000 hours in the F-18, so I know you were looking for a particular type of airplane, but 161963, we called her Jenna, and that's the airplane that I flew. I have almost 1,000 hours as a Blue Angel pilot in that one airplane. It's now on display at the San Diego Flight Museum because they've retired it, but that airplane, I've literally molded around me.
You win for not just naming a type of a plane, but an actual specific aircraft. And the fact that it was owned by the government is even more impressive.
Yeah. I knew how that airplane turned, moved, rolled, accelerated. We were one when we were flying for sure.
How wonderful. Okay. Question number two. Can you think of either a scary or incredibly impactful moment in your life, flying or not, that you believe you really learned something from, that took away something that has kind of changed your perspective?
Oh, that's a little bit of a tough question. I'll keep it to aviation. So when I was flying with the team, January 16th, 2001, we were demonstrating a maneuver for the first time, and I avoided the ground in a vertical dive element. And I truly believe that ground effect is what prevented the airplane from impacting the desert in El Centro. And there's a series, you know, you've heard, all your pilots that are listening heard of the Swiss cheese model, right? It's not one thing, it's a series of things that line up that trigger a causal chain of events. And so our minimum altitude for that maneuver was 2,000, and I bottomed out at 27 feet. So there were a number of things, not any one event that caused that to happen, but that was a moment where we went back, we looked at the standard operating procedures for the team to try to figure out how we could tighten everything up, because clearly that was far too close. And I'm happy to talk about that incident when I do keynotes at corporate events and what you can learn from it. And I flew again the next day to get back in the airplane. And wow. So, but that was kind of an epiphany. Like we mitigate the risks in a high risk environment to the point that we could get comfortable. And I'm not saying I was comfortable that day because it was the first maneuver, but it's one of those things in the back of my mind that what we do as aviators and the mechanics that prepare the airplanes and hand them over to us, I should say hand their airplane over to us, that it's high risk, and you can't ever forget that, and do everything that you can and to mitigate those risks.
Wow. Well, that is certainly a very good lesson learned, and I'm glad that you are with us here today for ground effect and those 27 feet. Question number three. If you could go back to one moment in your life, to not to change it, to be there, to re-experience it, something you thought was really quite special to savor again, what would that be?
To savor one more time, one specific event. I will go to both Wyatt and Nick's, our two boys' wingings, because their accomplishments as a parent are far greater than anything that I have done, and to see them succeed in a goal that they have achieved, and they are both F-18 pilots now, I just revel in everything that they do. I get to relive a little bit of what I have done, but knowing what they do makes me wildly proud.
That is such a wonderful sentiment. I believe that wholeheartedly. I believe that with both of my boys, you try to make children better versions, better than yourself. And the ability to do that, to do their wingings, to be there for that and see their success and read the stories of Wyatt's first carrier landing. That is truly wonderful. And I'm really happy for you, my friend. That is fantastic.
Thank you. Okay. I appreciate that.
Question number four. If you could go back in time and give some advice to your younger self from your teens or 20s, whatever time period it be, what do you think you'd say?
Oh, honestly, I'll be honest with you, because we talked about honest debriefs. I was really great at the squadron parties, in living that fighter pilot piece. You know, your parents tell you that nothing good happens after midnight, and I don't regret anything that I have done, but I actually passed this to the Blue Angels when I was with them on Saturday. I don't regret the partying, but I wish that I would have done it less so that I could focus more on all of the good things and the influence. I don't think that any of the Make-A-Wish, the veterans, the hospitals, the high school kids, I was all in. But in hindsight, I don't know what I would have done to do more, but I would go back and do more during those 3 years and through my tour. But I hope that those that I have served with, those that I have worked with, those that I have flown with look back favorably on any influence that I was able to give, but I would give more positive influence and motivation.
Well, I know for a fact that that is how they view you, because that is why you are here on this show and why I was connected to you.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. Question number five of Social Flight's Fast Five. If you could choose anyone with us, no longer with us, someone from the past, the present, famous or not, to spend an evening with, who could come to mind?
Yeah, I automatically go to Nancy King, who is my wife's mother, who passed away in 1989, and I never got to meet her. Although I see much of my wife in her, and all of her aunts and uncles have said that she is just like her, but I would very much like to sit down and have dinner with her and spend time with her.
That is quite sweet and such a nice sentiment for your wife as well.
Yeah, I don't know that I've told my wife that, but that's the first name that popped into mind. So,
well, a new revelation for your marriage here on Social Flight Live.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, Scott, I just want to say thank you so, so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. I hope that you'll consider coming back in the future and diving into some of the things we didn't even get to. I really cherish our time together.
I appreciate it, Jeff, and all the Social Flight listeners. Thanks for staying tuned and listening to the stories, and never give up your passion and say yes. There's great things.
I love that. Say yes. The book is Full Throttle, available on Amazon, and of course, check out the blueangelsfoundation.org. And again, Scott, thank you so much for your service, for your time, and for sharing yourself with us here on the show this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Good night.
Good night.
And to all of you, thank you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We are not here next week, but we are back on February 11th. Actually, it's our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff. You can register for that show at cockpit, the number two, and the word cowl, cockpit2cowl.com. We're going to be talking about propellers. It's a big show, all about props, all sorts, all types, and focusing on one of our partners, Hartzell Propellers, and some amazing news that they've got coming out. But we're going to learn about it from the cockpit, from the pilot's perspective, from Brian, from a commercial airline perspective, and then, of course, from a mechanic's perspective, from my side, maintenance, all sorts of things maybe can add a little bit to your knowledge base, make you a safer pilot, maybe save some money in maintenance, help you out in every way possible. That's Cockpit to Cowl, and that is on February 11th. Here on the show. And then we are back with Social Flight Live on February 18th. That's Tuesday, February 18th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, as always, with YouTube's Mindy Schmindy Linda. And I'll tell you, that is going to be a lot of fun as well. Great show. And she is really inspiring and such a sweet, sweet, wonderful human being. And so I hope you'll join us here for that show as well. Until next time, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I wish you all blue skies.